This is side two, continuing with Tom Gold on 24th June, 76. And so Woolley just said, get rid of this.
Get rid of this, and then there was another item. I had wanted the solar department to equip itself with a high-definition solar magnetograph. I had argued that the most important thing to remain to be done was not just look at every goddamn flare and chromospheric eruption or something, but get to know more about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the obvious thing was the magnetic field. And so I had said, well, one has to build a much higher definition magnetograph. It need not be able to measure weak fields. Previous to that, the only magnetograph that people had made using the Zeeman splitting was able to measure down to quite low field strengths and measure the field quite accurately. And I said, well, that's not what's interesting me. I don't care whether the field is 2,000 Gauss or 3,000 Gauss. But I want it on the scale of the flares.
Right. High angular resolution.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. High angular resolution, a very coarse resolution in field, if you need to accept that. And I had then lined up one Jim Ring, who was then prepared to come and join the observatory. We'd arranged an appointment would be offered him and so on to build such a gadget. Because he's a superb optics manipulator, and I'm sure he would have done a very good job. And again, Woolley just threw that out. And in fact, at the IAU meeting in Dublin just before when he was already appointed, but before he'd come to the observatory, he was so rude to Ring that Ring immediately informed me that he was not going to come. So with that attitude, I mean, it was just absolutely clear that I couldn't stay there.
Okay.
And so then, when I couldn't stay there, then I had dickered a little with other astronomical appointments in Britain. And then I have, out of the blue, a telegram from Harvard, which is to offer you a full professorship. And that sort of thing's the matter.
Now, was there anything else at Harvard that you wanted to describe relevant to radio astronomy? You were director there for a year?
2 years.
2 years.
2.5 years.
And this was, of course, when many students came through, which are now leaders in the field, like Heeshan and
Heeshan, Frank Drake.
Right. There's about a half a dozen of them. Do you have any idea how you were able to pick what can now be seen as being very successfully?
No, I don't think that I can really claim any credit for that. That was done with a whole committee work of going over records and so on. No, it's also just that to get into Harvard as a graduate student is tough, and you have that selection list.
So what attracted you to Cornell?
Well, the Arecibo situation. The Arecibo situation, it was that Cornell, I'd been at Cornell for one semester, and I'd also, on a personal basis, liked it better there. But only that. And I didn't like the big city life of Cambridge, Mass. And so. But I really had nothing against Harvard. I found that very pleasant, too. But I was not yet so deeply settled there. And when Cornell came and said, well, they'll offer to set up an interdisciplinary center for radio astronomy and various other topics that would combine engineering and physics. So. And they would want to offer me the directorship of this. And, I found that is very... They would do that, and, mind you, and that the planning that Bill Gordon had meanwhile been doing for building a large radio telescope, that would be part of this package.
I see.
That would be part of this center.
So this was 59 now when you...
This is now 59, yes.
And what stage was Arecibo at then?
That in negotiation with with the Defense Department.
So it had all been all designed, and you had a price, and you were just trying to get the...
No, by no means, no. Oh. It was just that the money for it was sort of earmarked in the Defense Department. And the background of it, it goes back a bit further. And I have to be very careful about that, because there was some strife between me and Bill Gordon in later years, and be very careful that I don't overstep anything. What my complete recollection is that in 56, I believe, or 57, I suppose, I was in Boulder at some meeting where Bill Gordon was also mm-hmm. present. I was then at Harvard and he was at Cornell, but I knew him. And he was on an NSF committee to concern itself with the question of building large radio telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, at that time, so far as I know, no notion of doing any such job himself. He was merely an engineer concerned with...
Consultant to this committee.
And I discussed with him then the situation. I said, well, we have a large steerable dish built in the Jodrell Bank. I had always wondered whether a fixed dish, very much larger, or a steerable one, not so large, were the best thing to do. Now that there was a large steerable one,
yeah,
I felt that a very large non-steerable one was the next step to take. And I gave him the views that I talked to you earlier about, that the radar to the planets required a big and not very steerable instrument and so on. And so I persuaded him to carry to this committee the notion of a large non-steerable dish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and to my knowledge, that is indeed what he did. But then, within a year of that time or so, he or Ken Bowles, and history does not know exactly who, or whether both independently, developed the notion of incoherent scatter from the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And he had undoubtedly the wrong picture of the physics of it, and Ken Bowles what turned out to be the right version, namely the critical matter, whether the bandwidth of the scatter signal is that of the thermal motion of the electrons or of the ions.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the debate, and Ken Bowles had no idea why he said the right thing either.
Yeah.
And I remember debating it with them on a visit that I paid to Cornell, and even had a bet on the subject. I wrote it up on a wall so it couldn't be lost. in which I sided with Ken Bowles, and gave indeed the reason that if you were dealing with a wavelength whichever way around it is, shorter than the Debye length, then you would be following the ions and not the electrons. The electrons would be following their ions, and the density fluctuations you would be seeing would be the density fluctuations of the ions, and therefore the bandwidth would be the ion. Of course, very critical, because the whole thing would not have been doable. We've only now, with the most sensitive receivers and the whole of our receiver, only now, after that many years, been able to get an electron signal from the place where the regime is reversed. So,
that's
in other words, if it had been,
interesting.
If it had been that it really
yeah.
was the bandwidth
yeah.
of the electron, you'd never have seen that.
Hmm.
You wouldn't have seen it. It wouldn't have worked. And Bill Gordon thought that that's what it was. And it would not, in fact, have worked. And whatever calculations he must have made at the time must, in fact, have been an error, because he claimed mm-hmm. he couldn't. But Ken Bowles had it right. But it was this incoherent scatter that Bill Gordon then took as the main reason for building the kind of instrument which, however fitted in its approximate description, what mm-hmm. we had previously discussed as being the next desirable thing to build.
Right. So you weren't around pushing Arecibo at that point?
No.
Yeah.
No. I wasn't, and I claim no credit for that. But I do claim that I was the yeah. person who first stuffed Bill Gordon's ears full of notion that a fixed dish yeah. in the ground was a good yeah. thing. And he had what turned out to be really a wrong reason for building yeah. it. But luckily, it was turned right by the...
When did this get straightened out relative to the construction of Arecibo?
I think Arecibo had already begun by then, before Bill Gordon was persuaded that it was going to be the iron bandwidth.
So you're claiming that he didn't really appreciate that the whole thing wouldn't have worked if he had been right himself.
Amazing. That's what I would say. That's what I would say.
But anyway, when you got to Cornell, Arecibo was
in the talk stage with the Defense Department, and shortly after I assumed the directorship of the center, the first construction meetings and so on.
Was this under the center?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was immediately from the beginning put under the center. And therein then lay a problem that Bill, when the thing became a very large project, then Bill Gordon felt that he should not have been constrained to be under anybody's center, and he mm-hmm. wanted to be directly under the Vice President for Research as a separate thing. While other contracts, of course, were not. You know, my center yeah. had another 20 different contracts, but none of them were as big.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, this produced some troubles. Bill Gordon just wanted to be totally independent, although I think that I never interfered with his management of his contract in any way. Unfortunately not, because I had misgivings about the feed right from the beginning, which turned out to be correct. And
can you be more specific?
A contract was given to one Alan Kay in Cambridge, Mass. For the feed, which was the only technically difficult, I mean, scientifically.
Not the support structure, but the feed itself.
The feed itself.
The line feed.
The line feed was the only thing where there was an electrical scientific problem involved. And Kay, industrial company, claimed that they had solved that, no problem.
This had never been done before, such a long line feed.
No, not even an object of that general nature. I had some experience with antenna work during the war. I understand antennas, I think, quite well, and I was very skeptical of this object right from the start. When it finally was put in there, the whole dish was 6 dB below par. That's an awful lot.
Did you say six?
6 dB, yes. Yeah. That's an awful lot. You know, it's a quarter of the size only that it should be for
right.
collecting area. And I suspected that the feed was involved. And there was a period where Bill Gordon kept saying, oh, no, it'll only be, it has to be, maybe it's not quite correctly adjusted focally, and we'll have to move it up a bit and move it down a bit. But 2 years went by, and it still wasn't any better. And so then eventually a little bit of a more careful survey was done of the electrical properties of the whole system, and it showed that it was indeed substantial error. And then I invited Ron Bracewell to Cornell and discussed with him whether he would spend some time on the matter of trying to find out what was wrong with the
field. What year is this now in Bracewell?
I suppose we could look that up, but I suppose it must be six. By then, I mean, the machine is built, so then we're at 64 or 5.
So the 2 years before that was when there was this adjustment and troubles and...
Well, I forget. When was our receiver finished? That sort of main construction?
61 or 2 or something like that? I'm positive.
63, and maybe Bracewell was there at 65?
Something like that.
Something
okay.
like that. We can look it up. But at any rate, Bracewell then investigated the matter, and I also had one Vic Rumsey given a small contract for investigating feeds of this nature. And before long, Bracewell really came up with the first key idea of why it was wrong. The azimuthal modes of the radiation pattern of the feed and demonstrate that that was an error. And then I think Ramsey came up with the polarization error calculation that showed that to be also substantially wrong. And it was quite clear that the feed was basically no damn good. And then followed a very distressing, to me, terribly distressing period. The I mean, it was a very major item for us. You see, this feed. We lost 6 dB, it was no joke. And of course, Bill Gordon was always a little bit constrained to belittle it and say, well, you know, but we still have the discrimination of the other advantages. So, but I couldn't really see myself supporting, you know, speaking in favor of a successful instrument if it was 6 dB below par. And so I organized that ARPA, and were giving us money then, allowed me to place a contract for a better feed. We couldn't possibly do that ourselves, we decided. We had the input from people like Ramsey, who'd worked by then for over a year, and Wilibinski, worked for over a year on this deal. And we had a reasonably good idea of how we might go about it. We then went to one Alan Love at Autonetics in California, and he's a great antenna designer. And we made a contract, placed a contract with him to go into that. And all was fine. He made some measurements, and he then suddenly told me he was momentarily stuck because there was a problem that he could not solve. I cannot quite now, at the moment, I don't place correctly which the electrical problem was. But he... Yes, we will. I can't now quite remember the details of that. So many years ago now.
That's all right.
But in any case, there was a serious technical problem. And he, at that moment, neither he nor I nor Ramsey nor anybody else saw a clear way through that. And so I said, well, in that case, we'd better sit back and think for a little while. But you're running a big contract there, and if we sit back and think, all your staff and everything else gets put on the payroll of this contract, and you run out of money before we've done the thinking. So I said, should I not interrupt the running of the contract temporarily? And so Autonetics will not charge any overhead. And so Love says, yes, yes, by all means, there's no point in wasting our money that way. And so I go to ARPA and I say, we wish to make a temporary interruption of this contract. And we will resume it as soon as we've been able to puzzle out this. So at the moment, all we want to do is to have Mr. Love think about it.
Yeah.
And so we do that. And a short time later, a statement comes from ARPA. It is obvious that you have failed with the whole contract work, and we've decided, instead of temporarily interrupting it, we've cancelled it.
Wow.
We've cancelled it. By the time that this letter comes, Love has already found what is a brilliant solution to this whole problem. It turned out to be a brilliant solution. So I write back furiously and say, no, by now we already know how to do it. Too late.
Yeah.
Out. Finished. We then go on for 3 years.
Okay.
Before, under somebody else's management, Pettengill, the Defense Department allows another contract to be placed.
To actually build the feed.
That other contract is then done to exclude me carefully because I had goofed. Is that story?
Right.
It picks up precisely where we left off.
Yeah.
It has big, major meetings with all kinds of important antenna consultants. It ends up advising that the Love solution be accepted, which is the one that he had had at that time.
Yeah.
It goes back to Autonetics. They design the feed. The feed is built. It works brilliantly.
When
and 3 years were lost, and in addition to an extreme measure of annoyance for me.
Was that 68 when the feed finally...
Something like that, yes.
Now, was this when Lalonde came into the scene under Pettengill?
No.
Is that still later?
That feed is nothing to do with Lalonde. That feed is the circularly polarized feed, which is the difficulty. The linearly polarized feeds, I regarded as trivially simple right from the start.
And these are the ones that Lalande
has been... And that was my prescription from the beginning that Lalande is making. It's just, say, Taylor make the width of a guide so it makes the right phase velocity and measure it, and you can't go wrong. And that's all that Lalande has been doing. I mean, I don't want to belittle him, he's done it very well, but that never was a problem. The great electrical problem had only to do with how to, when you did not have this freedom, because you had to emit circular polarization. Mm-hmm. And for going through the ionosphere, you must do circular.
Yeah.
And so we were involved with that difficulty. And then Love had found this brilliant solution with the little hats every few inches, which is what the present feed is. And that, I mean, the final thing, after all the heavy meetings and all the nonsense that went on, and 3 years clean wasted, it was finally built at a cost that must have been enormously more than what it would have been had that initial contract been allowed to continue. And that was the biggest mess I ever got into because of an absolute idiot in the Defense Department by the name of Colonel Dow. I know this is going down on record, but I wouldn't even mind if you heard it. Who must have been the worst manager of large sums of money that I've ever seen.
When did Arecibo do its first astronomical observations?
I don't remember the time table too well.
I mean, was it only once this feed?
Oh, no. It was a long time with the old feed.
With the 6 dB loss?
Yes. Yes. But, I mean, we could have. I mean, Bill Gordon, I think, was largely inclined to smuggle the whole... the whole problem away. I mean, just say, well, it's a very fine instrument and all is well. And, nobody needs to calculate just exactly how many you ought to be, how many flux unit you ought to be seeing from any source. And I wasn't quite willing to do that. So. Well, and Bill Gordon, I suppose, thought that I would pick on the shortcomings of the instrument to work him. As a personal sort of...
What did you see as the major contribution to astronomy that this instrument can make, besides the radar astronomy?
I was myself very keen on the radar, of course. And I was very keen also that we should have an in-house radar team, which finally, when the NSF took over, they did not want. And that was also a bone of contention between me and the NSF. I thought it was absolutely ridiculous to have an instrument like Arecibo, which is so ideally suited for radar, and not have a permanent team on the site to use it for radar.
Yeah.
Because it's very difficult to do radar as a guest observer, because you have to do year after year, every step you take helps you for the next round of observation. You have to get the ephemerides more accurate than they've ever known before you can even observe the next thing.
Sure.
So it was through my intervention there that I got Pettengill on board in the first place, made him associate director. And he then got the radar business working there. That was my management. And I had hoped to build up from Pettengill a permanent group there.
I suppose you were also interested, you were involved in this controversy over whether spaceships would sink in the dust in the moon and so forth, and the radar would help to discriminate.
Well, I was certainly keen on moon radar. Mind you, I terribly misquoted on this business of spaceships sinking in the moon.
It's not directly radio astronomy, but I'm still curious as to what you would say about it.
I know. Well, in fact, I used the earliest radar data to say that it was clear that the moon had a dusty surface, which was remarkably smooth. And the earliest data were 10 centimeters, were relevant to this, were the 10 centimeter data taken at TRE in Britain. And they showed a very substantial central bright spot on the moon, you see.
Yeah. Now, you said you had used the 10-centimeter TRE data.
To say that the moon had as much too smooth a surface at 10 centimeter to be understood as the impact-scarred hard rock surface. And I've taken that to imply a dust-covered moon. I had always insisted that it was dust, that it was a deep deposit of it, but by no means that it would be soft. I had said in those earliest years such things as, it's a deep deposit of small particles that makes up the plains on which Denver stands. Yet when you land on your plane in Denver, you don't expect to sink kilometers down.
Yeah.
So I definitely said that way around, you see. So the deposit is very deep, but how firm or loose it is, I cannot tell.
Right.
I would say that the main danger in a landing would be blowing of dust in the exhaust, and that indeed it was. There was a danger, mm-hmm. and the first mission was almost aborted because of that, you know. And that I insisted on would be the case, because I couldn't see that it could be firm enough not to blow up in it. But so far as the strength,
the bearing strength
concerned, I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
My feeling is that in a vacuum, it's much more cohesive. I've written that many papers, much more cohesive than such a powder would be in air. But even in air, such a powder might well have enough bearing strength. On the other hand, I said, without having been treated by wind and water, the moon's surface is not assured of having everywhere been tested with a certain load.
Mm-hmm. Right.
While on the Earth, almost everywhere you know it has been so tested.
Right.
I said there are a few places that have not been so tested, and there one has to walk with the greatest care, namely glaciers.
Yeah.
Because the snow on a glacier has only been there for a short time.
Yeah, the winter previous.
And there you don't know whether it's safe. And I said, well, I would regard it in the same sort of light, of saying, if I were to walk around on the moon that had not been tested with wind and water, I prefer to be on a rope.
Yeah.
That's what I said. But for the bearing strength, no, I thought that probably the vehicle would be all right, but I would bear it in mind that there is a possible problem.
So you were not particularly interested that Arecibo shed light on this?
Well, you see, let me say one more thing. Yeah. All the newspaper people always came out with this absolute rubbish that when I said that the deposit is some kilometers deep, they wrote, gold says you will sink kilometers deep in this stuff. And I could stand on my head. I said, look, you go to a sand dune and it's so deep, you don't expect to sink to the depth of that. But the newspapers always, and I found out in the end, one reason for that is that they had all read Mr. Arthur Clarke's rubbish of a fall of moon dust, who acknowledges here the idea of dust from me, and then he wrote a novel out of that in which people apparently have never read it, but which they do sink out of sight. So that's how this whole miserable story comes about. But it pursues me around the world. People saying, oh, but you weren't right about the depth of the dust. I said, well, I'm damn right about the depth of the dust. And I never said you'd sink that deep into it. There's always the same story. People always identify the depth of the dust with the sinkage.
What you're talking about is how far you have to go down to get bedrock.
Yes.
And what is the current story on that? I guess it's not known, really. It's only been probed directly, anyway, a couple meters.
My lunar colleagues always hope that the bedrock is just below the deepest that they have probed to. The radar, as I talked today, you wanted my talk, right?
No, I didn't.
The radar evidence on the moon is absolutely overpowering that there is no bedrock to a depth of several hundred meters.
Several hundred? Mm.
Because at the long radar wavelengths, we've seen the moon at 7.5 meters resolved in fine detail. And at 7.5 meters, the transparency of the soil that we've measured is such that you would go of the general order of 50 wavelengths, 100 wavelengths into the ground.
Yeah.
And if there were rough bedrock underneath, you would see the echo from that. It would give you a much brighter moon than we have, and it would give you virtually no limb darkening.
Yeah.
And the moon is limb darkened by 32 dB.
Mm-hmm. Okay, was there anything else in your direction of the whole Arecibo building and so forth that...
I was always the one to organize more the radio astronomy work there, Well, Bill Gordon was interested in almost entirely the ionosphere.
What was the main thrust of the radio astronomy
programs? Oh, mix. All kinds of things. And of course, the moment the pulsars came along, we were very hot on the pulsars.
But you weren't particularly directing a program that you had interest in. You were just taking proposals and just deciding their merit.
That's right. I was taking proposals, deciding their merit. I was discussing here and there individual programs with people, but that's all.
And you never, I don't think, actually got involved in a radio astronomy observer yourself?
No.
Rather curiously, perhaps. Haven't you ever had that urge with your radar background?
Well, it's when you're directing a big instrument like that, it's not all that easy. And also, I never spent any long periods of time down there. I sort of got established. I would go down there once a month. Supervise the running of it, straighten out all the personal strife that went on and all the nonsense that went on, and then came back. And I would have had to have stayed a considerable period of time down there. But I always had a local director, and if I stayed down there, I was afraid that I would get in his hair. It's always a little touchy business. If I, as the overall boss, go and spend time down there, but while Bill Gordon was the local director, I wouldn't in any case, because there was a little friction.
Right.
And then later it sort of got me established.
Sure, I can see that. So you basically just did not have the time, you're saying.
Didn't have the time, mostly, yes.
Well, now, the last thing, I guess, is if you could just talk about the discovery of the pulsars. You heard about them along with everyone else, and then what your interpretation was and how they struck you in those first few months.
Well, I suppose it was in February, end of February, the Nature article was published. It was the first that I'd heard. Frank Drake, who was then the local director at Arecibo, immediately proposed to do observations, and I, of course, immediately concurred with that, and that was done. And I think 3 days after the Nature article had reached Arecibo already had better data on the then one known position, pulsar, 1919, had better data on it than Cambridge had ever been able to obtain, of course, because of bigger power. My view was immediately that went back to what I told you earlier, the notion small condensed objects would be able to radiate well because of magnetic fields, big gradients, and so on. And so I immediately worked out just sort of a number of things. And I worked out, firstly, what would be the spinning speed of a neutron star that had collapsed from ordinary stellar angular velocities, and what would be the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a complete surprise to me how enormous these two figures turned out.
Yeah.
And apparently a complete surprise to everybody else too. And my figure, I mean, I just invented that figure of 10 to the 12 Gauss, which is sort of the canonical figure now.
Right.
But I just wrote, well, I suppose that ordinary stars may have fields of the order of 100 Gauss, and by the time you collapse it, that's what it comes to.
Right.
Can't help you. And the spin's the same, you see, and the kinetic energy of the spin. And so I, just from doing these simple calculations, immediately convinced myself that the only sensible source of energy that a neutron star would possess would be spin. The cooling was trivially easy to come to the conclusion that it would be very fast. And so therefore any heat from the compaction is immediately lost. So if these objects were any collapsed stars, if they were neutron stars, well then the energy must come from the spin. There's no other energy they have.
Right.
And I calculated various other things immediately. The brightness temperature, the number of ergs per square centimeter, on the assumption but the pulse length defined the approximate size of the radiating region, as it must do. It could be smaller, but not bigger. So when I did that, I immediately concluded the fantastic temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first sort of figure was, I think, 10 to the 21 degrees. So I said, well, obviously you cannot have, that's 10 to the 17 EV electrons. Mm-hmm. You can't have 10 to the 17 EV electrons in the vicinity of a small object. You can neither accelerate them nor would they radiate in the radio waves. They'd radiate like crazy in the gamma rays.
Right.
Any kind of curvature, even with a field of, I don't know, 10 to the minus 10 Gauss, they still radiate gamma rays. So that's obviously nonsense. So therefore, I immediately said it must be a coherent radiation, as you see. It's the only way in which you can get that intensity. So then I said, well, a coherent radiation, I would understand best as being due to a cloud of electrons whirling around, and I still think to this day that that's the best story, because then they can readily organize themselves
mm-hmm.
into a spatial pattern.
Like a bunch of coherence. Like a traveling wave tube.
Yes, that's right. They're all going at almost the same speed in any case, you see.
Right.
But if you have any other accelerating mechanism to make energetic electrons, well, then I don't understand that it could be so well organized.
Yeah.
Rotation is just ideal for that. And then I immediately noted another effect, namely that the clock precision, the mean precision of the clock, was enormously greater than the pulse-to-pulse precision.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you must have an underlying clock on which the individual pulses can make an error without, however, resetting the clock by that error. And I immediately said, well, that argues completely against it being any kind of radial pulsations. Because if anything was radially pulsating, then I would understand it that the next pulse would come into a particular phase of the previous one.
I see. Yes.
The next pulse is sitting on top of the previous. There's no underlying clock.
So that's what puts you off white dwarfs from the start, you're saying?
Yes. There's no underlying clock, you see. I can't have a radial pulsation that has no underlying clock. One pulse is determined by the phase of the previous.
Right.
And that is so clearly in conflict with the most primitive plot that you make of pulsar.
Yeah.
Now the individual phase errors, you know, are enormous.
Yeah.
But then you take the mean over a day and it's absolutely accurate to 8 decimal places, you see? So clearly out. And I must say I was very disappointed that people didn't understand that. Even now in the X-ray stuff, I had to get up in an X-ray conference at MIT recently and explain all this story again, that they had to investigate the X-ray by the same analysis to see what the right kind of story was.
Yeah.
They didn't understand it even now. But in any case, that was certainly the thing that persuaded me that I must have an underlying clock. An underlying clock is surely rotation. So I said, well, if it's rotation, then it must be neutron stars, because it's much too fast for the white dwarfs.
Yeah.
Then we'd understand the magnetic field strengths of that order. The energy is high for the white dwarf. You never had much energy either, you see. Because the collapse, the big energy comes from the collapse, from the white dwarf density to the neutron star density. That's where the big energy comes from. And a lot of that goes into the spin. Well, the white dwarf never has much energy of any kind. So I said, as a neutron star, you understand the underlying clock, you understand the strong magnetic fields, you understand the large amount of energy available in the spin, and so surely that must be the right story. And then I said immediately, then you would expect that there would be young ones that are much faster,
mm-hmm.
that they would all be slowing down, but that the youngest would be slowing down the most.
Was this before the slowdown had been found?
Yes, all right.
How long did that take? How long a time scale?
Well, I wrote the article in Nature, it was published in May, and Arecibo discovered the slowdown of the crab in September or October.
Well, the crab wasn't found until a year later or so, was it? Was it that early? Only a few months after the first pulsar? I was thinking that it was...
A year later?
A year later sort of thing. But was the crab the first one to have a slowdown picked up also?
Well, the crab, the slowdown.
It makes sense because it's slowing down the fastest.
Yes, it was immediately seen from one day to the next. The slowdown was seen.
Well, I'll check that.
Check the date.
I had the idea that Stalen Reifenstein was summer 69 or something like that.
Well, it could be, it could be that I'm all out by 1 year.
Yeah. But anyway,
yes, that's probably right.
Your slowdown paper, you think, may have been a year later also?
That was absolutely the first thing.
Prediction was still in the spring of
68. Prediction was absolutely the first thing, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That immediately said that we'd expect to find pulsars in Dunga. It said everything. It said we would expect to find them in the locations of supernova shells. Because neutron stars can only be made as a result of a dramatic explosion.
You were not bothered by the fact that there were no apparent supernova remnants near the...
In the others.
Near the nova.
No, I took that in my stride and said we'll find younger ones that will have supernova shells. Okay. If they're neutron stars, they should be associated with supernova shells. If the supernova shells are still visible, then they will be younger, and they will be spinning faster.
Right.
We'd see them, we'd see the spin down, and that was, of course, all to be substantiated. Yes, but it may be that it was only substantiated a year later, yes.
Yeah.
And then I wrote another paper a year later in which I put in the rate of energy loss from the crab.
That fits so nicely,
that
right?
That fits so nicely,
yes. Right. Well, I think that's about it, unless you can think of any other comments along the long trail that you followed that you might like to make.
Yeah. I must say, do you transcribe all this?
Yes, so you'll be getting a transcription to correct and embellish if you wish.
Well, that's wonderful, but also I'd be quite happy to have a transcription because, in fact, I will. I've been asked by the National Academy to record a biographical few pages.
Right, right, okay.
And I don't have to go through the misery again. I can, at least to some part of it, just the radio part of it at least, I can just draw on this.
No, you definitely can have a copy of the final transcription, sure. Thank you.
Very good.
That ends the interview with Thomas Gold on 24th June 1976, and this is the end of the tape.